Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the sometimes forgotten but influential women in American history, and I'm your host, Krista. Welcome back to our discussion on the myth of the mistress, the plantation mistress, that is. Last episode, we discussed the life of the Southern Belle before she married, and then her life as a young bride, and then as the unacknowledged manager of the empire of her husband. We also touched on the extreme double standards and the odd circumstances and social constraints that these women lived in. But I have to share with you first the conversation that I had with my husband about our last episode. As some of you who are regular listeners know, my husband is in Korea for the year. So he listens to the episodes while I'm asleep because our time is about 14 hours off. My husband is well-versed in many subjects, but American women's history is not his forte. Now, if we wanted to hear about famous battles, he could educate us all on history and strategy, but the plantation life is definitely not a subject he would read about by choice. He lovingly listens to my podcast, which I appreciate, but I know these are not his areas of interest. So when I introduced the podcast and talked about the plantation mistress, he kept listening for me to introduce the identity of this mistress the plantation owner was hiding from his wife. He thought maybe I was going to talk about the female slave who was, in addition to being an enslaved worker, often turned into a sexual slave for the white man on the plantation. And my husband thought this might be sort of a play on words referring to her plight. So we were actually talking about the wife of the plantation owner. Also, he said that I should explain what laudanum is. Laudanum is a tincture of opium that was widely prescribed during the 19th century. It was used to treat just about every ailment you can imagine, and shockingly was given to babies in small doses to keep them from crying. So our illustrious prospective groom in the previous podcast, who fed his fiancée a peach injected with laudanum to steal a kiss, two times, by the way, was in effect drugging her with opium. So, in addition, when I was referring to movies from the Civil War, I meant to say movies depicting the Civil War. About the only movie we might get from the Civil War would be like a flip book of daguerreotypes made into a cartoon movie. And that would be interesting, heavy, but interesting, if discovered. But I definitely deserve to be teased for my misstatement there. So, honey, there is the definition and explanation portion of today's podcast. And onward and forward. For the rest of the podcast, I will be discussing adult behavior. So if you have children around, it is probably time to put on the headphones. I'm discussing a sensitive subject today that I don't really think it's discussed enough in history. I think that, I know there's not a lot of time to discuss things like sexual exploitation in just a normal college history class, but I do think in this case that it really is an important topic because the sexual exploitation of the female slave in the South, it tied into almost every aspect of the culture. And so I think it's important to discuss, to really understand the mindset of our forefathers. So female slaves faced a far greater burden than any other group of people in the South because they faced both physical and sexual exploitation. In addition to being forced to mate with male slaves, the master considered most advantageous for breeding better workers, female slaves were always in danger of being raped by their master or his sons or possibly his father. Thelma Jennings of Middle Tennessee State University published a study in 1990 that used research from the Works Progress Administration from the 1930s. The interviews were done with former slaves who had been young, but some of the women had been old enough to have gone through puberty before the Civil War and thus had dealt with sexual exploitation, or they were old enough to remember specific instances that may have happened to another slave. About 57% of the people interviewed knew of a specific instance where a master, son, overseer, or some other white man forced a female slave to have sex with him, and all former slaves commented that everyone knew who the mixed-race children were and noted as well that while some of the masters would refrain from actually beating their sexual favorite or their offspring whom they also owned, that quite often these children were sold off to get rid of the evidence. The behavior was justified by reasoning that the quote-unquote Jezebel black woman had really wanted the sexual contact and that the children, Even with a small amount of black blood, were not really members of the family. So some men had no problem profiting from the sale of their own children. This was a real and persistent problem that made the lives of all slaves an even more terrible burden to bear. For the purposes of today's podcast, though, I am going to address this problem from the perspective of the planter's wife. Now, please don't think that I somehow think the shame of knowing your husband was fathering children all over his plantation was somehow as painful as actually having to bear the children of the man who owned you, then raped you, and then sold off your children. But I do think we should address how the actions of these men affected their entire family. So, the pride of the plantation owner required that he carefully oversee all of his property. They were preoccupied with image. The image portrayed by their wives, their children, their chattel, and their farm made the man. Chattel, by the way, is property, and in this case, human property. And slaves were often referred to in contracts as chattel. The image used by Catherine Clinton, who was a historian, was that the son was the sturdy vine and the daughter was the fragile blossom, when you're talking about the actual white children of the plantation owner. Just like we discussed in our first podcast on the cult of domesticity, the mother was to be the pure and spiritual guide, not only for these children, but also for the slaves. If these women were really aware of the irony of trying to instill morals on a group of people that were being held in bondage by these moral teachers, few women really mention this about their diaries as they recounted sort of their day-to-day activities in their diaries. They didn't really blame the men in their lives either for the fact that female slaves failed repeatedly to live up to the ideal expected of them. Women often blame the genetics of the slave rather than their husbands, sons, or fathers, and perhaps pretended to believe that, you know, it didn't happen in their house, which is illustrated by the fact that while these women ignored this behavior often in their own family, they were very willing to discuss the transgressions in the households of others. Though you can imagine how upset some women were when their husband, who had carried on with with a slave mistress for an extended number of years, which many did, mentioned the children of the liaison in their will by freeing them. I couldn't even imagine that. So you're sitting at the reading of a will and there are read the names, you know, of these children who your husband owned, yet he fathered, and he's, you know, leaving them, you know, something. Yet these are people that are supposed to be your servants. So, I mean, you can just imagine how humiliating in the culture at the time that would have been for her. These women were very worried about what their children might see and often tried to separate the slave children and the white children, even though most white children would say that they grew up playing with the slave children in the yard all the time until they became old enough to understand that they were expected to behave differently around their slaves. Advice books warned mothers that allowing their children to interact too often with slave children would expose them to pernicious habit, I quote here. But mothers would not admit the elephant in the room, the fact that their children were well aware that their adolescent brothers would spend their nights in the slave cabins. Women were so concerned about moral behavior that it was common for a male doctor to set a woman's broken leg actually through her clothes. And women did get broken bones from horseback riding pretty frequently then. Amazingly enough, though, there seems to be some evidence that the naked slave really did not bother the white mistress after she spent so much time exposed to the slaves on her husband's plantation. This is not, I haven't read this in a lot of sources, but this is something I've seen in a couple of different sources that, this is something they saw all the time. During the Civil War, married women were more often used as nurses because they had been exposed to flesh and would not be scandalized, but an unmarried girl, with the soldiers, so you only had usually married women as nurses, but an unmarried girl really might see a naked black man being whipped in her yard, and no care was taken to cover him from her view. Now, that's not to say it never happened, and I'm sure looking back in diaries and journals or, you know, third-hand accounts that I'm sure that there were times when that was hidden, but it did happen, so this doesn't seem to be such a frightening thing to the culture as a whole. Again, showing the many double standards of sex and race in this culture. But back to that elephant in the room. Many women would, however, admit that the system of slavery was cruel, and that their husbands were often tyrannical, and that were it not an inevitable part of their lives, their children might grow up better outside the system. It was often the mistress of the plantation that would kind of lessen the workload of the pregnant slave to ensure that the baby would be carried to term, as well as better food rations. Now, this did not always happen, but in the instances where accommodations were made for pregnant slaves, a lot of times it was the mistress who made these accommodations and made the changes. Now, I am not saying that we will not see frustration from these women when the slaves begin to leave the plantations, when the masters leave to fight the Civil War, and that the wife does not have enough workers to help her produce the crop in the absence of her husband to sustain her family, that, you know, these things didn't make her angry. But many diary entries do show that often Southern women said that they of having a different way to maintain their livelihood other than having people that they considered foreigners living alongside them, being owned. So, you know, so it becomes the moral question. Could they do anything about it? Could they have changed it? I mean, you have the Grimke sisters, who are famous abolitionists, whose own brother fathered multiple children by one of his female slaves, and he, you know, owned slaves. Could they do anything? They could get mad about it. They could move north. They couldn't change the system. You know, had all the women banded together, could they have changed the system? I don't know, perhaps, but they were not living in a time where they necessarily had a choice. Some of them probably were perfectly happy with the system, but I think we know that a lot of them were not. They were not happy, and they understood that there was an imbalance in the system where one group of people had the vast majority of the power. So their fears were not only for their children, but also for their own chastity and reputation. Men truly believed that if a woman was willing to have sex before marriage, then she might also be willing to sully their family reputation with the possibility of having children with another man, and truly feared that she might have sex with a male slave. This was such an abhorrent thought in the South that few written accounts of liaisons between white women and slave men come from actual Southerners, but were instead found in the journals and writings of people traveling through the region who did not understand the intense social prohibition on the relationship. Now, in the North, you know, certainly mixed race couples were not accepted at all, but they were, you know, whether it was... you know, whether the female were white and the male were black, or the female were black and the male were white, I think it was pretty much treated with the same disdain. Here in the South, it was completely different. Often the, you know, liaisons with female slaves were ignored, but if a white woman had an affair with a black man, I mean, it was the most horrible thing that could possibly happen to a family. So, while a man was sleeping with a slave woman or prostitutes when traveling, a woman who was not perceived as virginal had little value in the marriage market of the planter class. Women wrote to each other with ways to protect themselves from bad influences, loud public behavior, and modest dress. They were concerned about punishment, which really meant being shunned by good society. Yet people were still people. Girls still wanted to get married, so double standards ensued. One bride was horrified at the girls at her wedding who were showing a bit too much cleavage and upper back. So, which I thought was really funny that she was really horrified about this. She wrote about it. The plantation mistress was expected to be very careful not to anger, as temper was considered one of the worst vices a woman could possess. Let's not be naive, though, to believe that the pregnant bride also did not exist. We've got all these lists of rules. There were girls that, when they got married, were pregnant, and they got married because they were pregnant. If the girl did not marry the father, the scandal could not be overcome, and sometimes the man might suffer from loss of reputation if the woman he would defiled, I'm using my quote fingers again, was white, by loss of business and social contacts. Girls who were not able to marry the father were often passed from family member to family member and often not treated very well. Even if they were abandoned by the man who may have made promises of love and devotion, the inability to moderate their own behavior brought shame to their whole family, and often the marriages of siblings and cousins were affected unless their own neighbors of the siblings and cousins felt that their behavior had been above reproach, and thus the family members deserved pity instead of derision because of, you know, the behavior of the shameful person. One example of this is actually General Lee's half-brother, who seduced his wife's sister and who then gave birth to his baby. His name was Black Horse Harry Lee, and he had a terrible reputation. But his brother, Robert E. Lee, did not suffer because of his brother's terrible behavior. His behavior was considered, you know, by the Southerners above reproach. He died exiled abroad and in disgrace. However, in most cases where men suffered public consequences for defiling a young maiden, it was generally because she was under the charge of another patriarch, and that man's authority had not been respected by treating the girl in his charge with respect. The problem wasn't necessarily because the woman had her own value and should be respected. It was because you had now insulted this patriarch. By the way, I have to say here that we don't usually talk about men, but it's funny when you read, Robert E. Lee was respected by a lot of people north and south. So anyway, kind of interesting, an interesting side note. Now, this is not to say that men were publicly licentious. There were behaviors that were thinly veiled. When walking down the street or attending a party in the presence of his wife, one would believe that these men were the epitome of the moral guide and leader in his home. The information we do have about the real behavior of men, though, was scandalously left by some men whose families did not find and destroy the diaries or private letters. And destroying these type of things were fairly common by families during this era, you know, all over the United States, all over Europe. You know, embarrassing writings were very commonly destroyed after a person's death. The family might go in the room and search the desk and search the office and find these things and destroy them, which, you know, is sad to us today, but was very important to them then. Referring to women as meat is not a 20th century invention, and while white women that were not marriage material, meaning they were working class, were white, they were fair game, according to these men, to be treated as meat. Venereal disease was commonplace on plantations to the point that some young men were often warned of the dangers on certain plantations when they were visiting. Believe it or not, sheepskin condoms existed then, and while they were not used to curb the spread of venereal disease, they were talked about between young men, as were populations of available girls that were not yet known to be infected by venereal diseases. Women who demonstrated sexual passion, in contrast, were considered to have some illness that needed to be treated with rest or cold compresses. So the men could, you know, cat around however they wanted to, but if a woman had true sexual desires, she had an illness. In addition to possibly being infected with some disease by her husband on the plantation, the mistress also worried about his drinking. Drunkenness was common among men in the South, and with this, along with the culture of power the slave owner lived in, women often felt the brunt of the inability of their husbands to rein in the beast that had been unleashed in his personality against their slaves when he drank. Wife abuse was common, and silly behavior like dueling over some small infraction or statement against his character went along with this culture of drunkenness. Funny fact, men were actually a bit concerned about a white woman's temper because she was part of the planter class, but he needed her submissive cooperation to run the plantation smoothly. So the strict social guidelines that made a woman's self-censure benefited these patriarchs. So if a wife really did get roused up and really angry at her husband because he was abusing the slaves or abusing her or abusing the children, or, you know, sometimes it had a little bit of an effect on a man's behavior. You know, sometimes it might actually curb a little bit of his behavior and make him think, or at least try to hide his bad behavior a little better. And as Roman virtue was concerned with honor to death, there were those who believed a fallen woman could only shake her bad reputation with death. A man could decide to defend his wife's honor against the man who had defiled her. Yes, I said defiled, funny enough, if she had had a reputation. Realistically, however, it could be determined that in defending the woman's honor, he was really defending his own honor from public shame and how it reflected poorly on him. The change in women's education during this era was not because society had somehow become more enlightened and, you know, it was her own honor and she didn't belong to the man anymore. It was because women were being used as moral examples and teachers of future leaders of the Republic that benefited society. So this is why you start to see maybe a few changes where the plantation master really didn't want his wife really angry at him, because perhaps he respected her as a moral guide somewhat, yet again, he still owned her. He still owned their slaves. He still owned their children. You know, he didn't really own her, but he still was in charge of everything. So, the Roman custom of protecting property interests was invoked during this era, changing the law, making the descent of the child follow the mother's line so that the owners could father a child that would be his property. That's how they managed to do that. Again, we see this, you know, the Roman custom. And with this retrospective of antiquity, where myths were propagated by practice to carry on customs, the myth of the perfect virginal woman lived on. So you see kind of some of the double standards and ways that they justified behavior. There is another myth of Scarlet that I found a bit amusing that I think is important to understand when observing the reality of the life of the plantation mistress. The mistress working from day to day in her home did not have the time or money to worry about high fashion. She was not looking for a husband anymore and was far too busy and active to wear her best dresses, though she would have to dress appropriately when she was beckoned to church or social event. Now, if you remember Scarlet's mother in Gone with the Wind, whether you read the book or you've seen the movie, wore dark colors with a severe neckline, and this honestly was a bit more realistic. Girls spent a great deal of time scrubbing and primping, but the married mother who worried about fashion was considered neglectful of her family. European fashions were prohibitively expensive for most families, but there were items that women were willing to splurge on. So hypothetical behavior related to dress and fashion is part of this very complicated cultural balance that these women lived in. Like I said, you know, we have your Roman influences because the South really wanted to sort of imitate this Roman culture, this, you know, highly elevated culture where you've got women who are venerated and put on a pedestal, but yet they have no power. Yet, you know, you don't want her to get angry because you need her to be the perfect mother and hostess and wife, yet your behavior is terrible all the time. So you have these great dichotomies all through this culture. So European fashions are prohibitively expensive. There were things they were willing to splurge on. So hypocritical behavior related to dress and fashion is really common. Catherine Clinton describes this well when she says that Southern women remained fascinated and tried to find an appropriate compromise between the evil of becoming slaves of fashion and the grace of dressing in a style reflecting position and wealth. Corsets were the epitome of this disparity. People knew that corsets were not good for women, and many people preached that lacing too tightly was vain and dangerous, but often girls would still attempt to rebel and make their waist as small as possible. Basically, the corset was the cell phone or the midnight curfew of the 19th century. Girls would complain if they were not allowed to wear a whalebone corset, and then they became, when they became women, dared to make their own choice as a quote-unquote slave for fashion. One thing that no girl wanted to do then was to be tan. That was very important. Thomas Jefferson, who is, I have to be honest here, I know a lot of people love him. He's not my favorite character in history. Actually told his daughter Maria that if she went into the sun without her bonnet, she would become ugly and that we should not love you so much. Pretty harsh, huh? This is not a political podcast, and I'm not going to take on the Federalist cause, but come on, old Thomas. You were having an affair with a slave woman and owning your children while you were telling your daughter. You will love her less if she's a little tan. How about paying off that huge debt you left to your heirs, dude? Maria probably didn't find that very attractive either. It was true that a man's reputation rested on the correct behavior and public persona of his heirs, and Thomas Jefferson just had to have the bad fortune of leaving letters that were scathing and very public. So you opened yourself to history's hottie's ridicule there, Thomas. But this podcast is not about Thomas Jefferson. This is about a woman who, like I said last time, was far too busy for, you know, idle things like listening to a podcast or perhaps reading for pleasure or doing any of the other things that she may have done before she got married. And I think that she is a personality that deserved discovering, that deserved some study, and hopefully we've, you know, done a little bit of covering that. And we will continue on with our series on plantation life and before and during the Civil War. We may switch topics next time and then come back to it. I don't know. We'll have to see where my research leads me. But anyway, I appreciate you guys listening today. And if you have any questions, comments, or snide remarks, all of which we accept, please feel free to contact me at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's historieshotties@yahoo.com. There's no apostrophe. And until next time.